You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Large-scale commercial fishing, extensive fish farming, and a lack of coherent regulations have pushed many wild fish species to the brink of extinction. As a result, eating seafood has become a very complicated matter for people looking to eat sustainably. In his latest book, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, Paul Greenberg explores our relationship with our oceans through four of the most popular fish species, salmon, sea bass, cod, and tuna. This book is published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased it has brought Paul Greenberg to our show today. Hello.
Thanks, Leonard.
You write in your introduction that our view of fish is tainted by, quote, a wave of psychological denial of staggering scope. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, 50 years ago, pretty much everything we ate from the sea was wild. You know, you can think of seafood, right? Now, almost half of what we eat from the sea is farmed. And that is the result of both the collapse of wild species and of a huge biotech revolution, the likes of which we probably haven't seen since humans came out of the caves 10,000 years ago.
Well, my mother always insisted that fish were brain food. Then she would feed us Mrs. Paul's fish sticks. Now, were the fish in that in those fish sticks wild fish at that time?
Sure. Well, you know, if you track the fish stick alone, you can see the progression of overfishing into fish farming. In fact, actually, if you look at the fillet of fish sandwich, right, when that was first introduced, it was actually halibut. But McDonald's told the inventor of the sandwich that he wanted to bring it down cheaper, and halibut were already declining. So then he slotted in cod. And of course, we all have heard about Mark Herlansky's book, Cod, and the collapse of cod, and that pretty much bottoms out cod in 94. Now it's Alaska pollock, or it has been Alaska pollock, but increasingly a lot of fast food places are starting to look at tilapia, which is a freshwater farmed fish from Africa.
And you can farm that fish in great quantities, so unlike the others, it'll never be an endangered species?
That's correct. In fact, actually, it runs the risk of endangering other fish. Tilapia are incredibly productive, both growers and spawners. And basically, if you introduce tilapia into any kind of environment, they will just keep breeding and fill up the whole pond. So there's actually a problem of too many tilapia escaping and taking over some American lakes and rivers. It's happened in the American South already.
You make the distinction between seafood and wildlife in the book.
Yeah. Well, I always found the word seafood to be kind of a disturbing word when you think about it. I mean, how many genera and families are crammed underneath that one word? I mean, there's no word land food, right? You wouldn't use the word land food to describe every piece of meat that we eat. But seafood is this way to me. It's a kind of a cover that we use to just pull whatever we want out of the ocean without really considering that these are wild animals that we're eating.
When the tilapia escape, do they become wild fish?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they'll take root.
And do they change because farmed fish are different? They have different coloring and they have different flavor because they don't swim as much, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Well, farm fish have many different characteristics. Both tilapia and salmon are the products of very long selective breeding programs. Salmon, I think, have been through 12 or 15 generations of selective breeding. So, the Latin word for salmon is Salmo salar, but some people have come up with the word Salmo salar domesticus, like it's almost another species. And the same things happen with tilapia.
Nutritionists and government officials are always encouraging us to eat more fish.
Sure.
If we're endangering all the various species by overfishing, what can we wind up eating?
Well, it's an interesting dilemma, right? Because, people, I find are first and foremost concerned about their health, and then they're concerned about the health of the earth. But it is true, if everybody were to follow, say, the British Health Ministry's advice, we would eat two portions of fish a week. And I ran the numbers on that. And basically, we would need to pull out the entire human weight of the population of the earth and humans out of the sea every year in order to come up with that many fish. So there simply aren't enough fish out there.
And then fry it. And then British then fry it.
Yes, they deep fry
it. Fish and chips.
Yes, which probably eliminates any kind of health benefit you might be getting from it. But yeah, but no, so we don't have enough wild food fish to meet our needs, which is why aquaculture has come along, and it's the fastest growing form of food production in the world right now.
And when did we start farming fish?
Well, actually, fish farming goes back 4,000 years on a small scale. The Chinese first did it as a polyculture. They would grow carp together with silkworms, together with ducks, together with rice, and it was actually a very well-balanced system. But the sort of industrial aquaculture as we know it today really began in the late 60s, and it's really part of that whole Green Revolution thing, you know, the tail end of the Green Revolution when people saw such incredible growth in rice and wheat and all those kinds of things. So it's really the late 60s when salmon, actually wild salmon, start to go in decline and start to almost go into commercial extinction in the Atlantic that it really goes full force with salmon.
So we saw it as a way of actually keeping these various species alive. But then now all we talk about is the harm that we're doing to the environment.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think anyone, when they started farming salmon, really imagined that it was going to get to the scale that it got. I mean, I think it's something on the order of 3 or 4 billion pounds of salmon that are grown a year. At the time, it was two brothers in a little fjord in Hitra in Norway started farming salmon. They thought, well, salmon's getting pretty expensive on the market. let's try and get in on this hot market. So they farmed a few salmon. But once, it was interesting, is a sheep breeder from Norway who actually came to America and learned breeding techniques. And he applied it to salmon. And the Norwegians were able to do these incredible strides in growing salmon quickly. And it took over the world. And salmon have now taken over the world. They're on every continent except Antarctica at this point.
And the Norwegian economy is based a lot on salmon, including smoked salmon. Does smoked salmon taste different if it's farmed salmon?
You know, I am not a big farmed versus wild purist. There certainly are those out there. But the big difference.
I can taste the difference.
Can you?
If you are in Seattle and you eat the salmon that has just been brought in by the fishing boats that day, you sure are tasting a different kind of salmon than you are when you're eating farmed salmon.
Yeah, but it's important to remember that that's a different species. And that, I think, is a primary difference. Sockeye, that bright red, you ever have that really bright red sockeye salmon? That's really dense, right? It doesn't have those sort of ribs of fat in it. But if you were to compare the taste of, say, a wild king salmon, which to my eye has that same sort of zebra-striped fat as an Atlantic salmon, the flavor isn't that different. Of course, you know, there are some people out there with harpoons in Alaska ready to kind of run me through when I say these things. But I think a lot of it is a species difference that I notice.
Do you think that fish farming has eased or worsened pressure on wild fish stocks?
You know, it depends on the species. In the case of salmon, I think it's been detrimental to Atlantic salmon because you have to farm salmon in the environment that salmon naturally live. And Atlantic salmon went into huge decline in the 60s after a small group of Faroese and Danish fishermen found the portion off Greenland where all the salmon in the world congregate, and they fished it really hard. And it's interesting to note that soon after the salmon were found in the wild, you know, really, really fished hard and went down, that's when salmon farming really starts. So all these salmon cages get put into fjords today, fjords or the Bay of Fundy in Canada. They can spread disease. They can spread sea lice. They foul the environment. And if it's not done right, it really actually suppresses the return of wild Atlantic salmon. So, you know, in that case, it's not such a great deal. Other situations, it's actually been beneficial to some degree. Like, do you ever eat Branzino?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a farm fish.
It is. It's a favorite in almost every Italian restaurant.
Exactly. And did you notice that it didn't really appear until about maybe 2000? And it suddenly, it's everywhere.
I thought we started importing it from the Mediterranean.
we did. But it's farmed. You know, the reason is, so Branzino, Loup de Mer, Bar, it's called different things, Robalo in Spanish, Spigola in Southern Italian. That was a fish that, it was like this huge, almost like a Manhattan Project in the Mediterranean, where all the nations of the Mediterranean contributed to domesticating this fish. And once they closed the life cycle and once they'd figured it out, it suddenly became this huge export item. So that domestication has actually eased pressure on sea bass. They're called European sea bass or Branzino, you know, depends on. But they're all over Europe, and the domestication of them has eased fishing pressure in the UK and the northern part of their range. So, you know, it's a mixed bag to some degree.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, who's written a book called Four Fish: The Future of the Last Wild Food. It's published by the Penguin Press. And well, the favorite fish and chips fish was a fish called plaice, which was, I guess, a kind of a flounder or a cod.
Yeah, that's a bottom fish.
Is that still around? Because there was an awful lot of fish and chips eaten over the last 100 years.
Certainly there were. I mean, there. You know, again, I return to one of the things that about fish is that we're not talking about extinction. We're talking about the end of abundance. And with plaice, certainly the abundance of plaice is over, and they can no longer be an industrial fish. They exist, but they're not going to be in fish and chips anymore.
Aren't farmed fish fed wild fish?
They are indeed.
Why is that? Why not just feed them more farm fish?
Well, there is some recycling that goes on, but I won't go into that right now. You know, you have to start somewhere. You need to have some marine protein to begin the whole process. And part of the reason, the thing that we feed farm fish are mostly little what are called forage fish, menhaden, herring, sardines, all those kinds of things.
The same kinds of fish that they would eat if they were out in the wild.
Yes, to some degree, except, and this is where some of the problems with farm salmon begin. Salmon in their wild environment are omnivorous. They eat shrimp and crustaceans and whatever, and they're actually the wild salmon actually therefore have lower toxins than farm salmon generally. So anyway, all of these little fish get ground up and put into pellets. And in the early days of salmon farming, it took anywhere from 3 to 6 pounds of wild forage fish to make a single pound of farm salmon. Now, the industry has changed things quite a bit. They've gotten more efficient. Some claim they've got it down to 1.5 to 1, maybe 1.1 to 1. One fisherman told me, he's like, how do they get it 1 to 1? Does the fish never poop? I mean, so there's a lot of shell game numbers gets thrown around.
How do farm fish differ from wild fish nutritionally, do they?
You know, by species, the tilapia, which, as you pointed out, is a great farmed fish in that it doesn't have a big ecological footprint, they don't have the omega-3 benefit that, say, a lot of wild fish do. But that's really just by virtue of what they eat and their biology. As far as, a farmed salmon versus a wild salmon, they both have omega-3s. They both have that heart healthy benefit. It's really the question of PCBs that is the difference between the two.
Every year, 3 billion pounds of farm fish salmon are produced.
Yeah.
That's three times the wild fish sold on the market annually. Do you think that consumers are even aware of that?
No, I don't. I don't. And it's funny, do you ever go to the supermarket and you see Irish salmon and Scottish salmon and Norwegian salmon? I mean, what's your assumption? Do you assume they're farmed or wild? I mean, do you just think Norway and that's that?
I unfortunately assume Norway, Scotland, Ireland.
Exactly. And, the country stands.
Otherwise, I probably wouldn't buy it because there is a bias among consumers against farm fish.
Of course. Of course. But, what people don't realize is that Atlantic salmon, which is what all the species, Salmo salar, Atlantic salmon, which is farmed in Ireland and Scotland and Norway, it is commercially extinct. You grew up, right? I grew up eating Nova lox, right? Didn't you? And Nova lox, Nova Scotia lox, it was a wild fish. There is no more wild Nova lox except for probably a handful of people who managed to pay the really high price for it. So, when we go back to the question you asked about denial and the psychological denial, the denial we're faced with is that we think we still have lots of wild salmon, but we don't.
Well, there's a widely held belief that farm salmon escape and then they breed with wild salmon. Is that true?
Breeding is hard to document. The problem I've heard about escapees, and they do escape, something on the order of 10 million salmon escape every year. And they escape not just in their native range in the Atlantic, but they're farmed in the Pacific. They're farmed in Chile. So they do all sorts of things. They might outcompete wild salmon for forage, for nesting space, and then in the end not really be able to reproduce. So, they could be displacing this functioning food system with a system that we need to support.
Why wouldn't they be able to reproduce?
I remember when I...
Because they're a new species? Is this like donkeys or burros, whatever?
No, and they're fertile. They're functional creatures. But I remember when I was in Oregon in the 80s, I counted salmon. And my boss, who was a salmon biologist, had his funny cartoon. And it was like farmed salmon on the one side and wild. And the farmed salmon, or the wild salmon, had a strong Kirk Douglas jaw and broad shoulders. And the domestic salmon was like, the ultimate 90-pound weakling. And it's true to some degree. Farmed salmon were selectively bred to eat fast, gain weight, and sit in a pen, whereas wild salmon are, they're bruisers. They're meant to compete and so forth. And, it hasn't really been fully documented how the displacing of wild fish with farmed happens, but it's certainly a concern and a potential phenomenon.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, who's writing on seafood and the oceans, has appeared regularly in the New York Times Magazine, its book review, the opinion page. His latest book is called For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. It is published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Paul Greenberg, whose book For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, is published by the Penguin Press. We've been getting comments from our listeners Robert left a comment on our show page. He says in the July 18th issue of The New Scientist, there was a claim made that one-third of the fish on sale in the United States is not the species it's sold as. Is that possibly true?
Oh, it's most definitely true. I mean, even when you hear about bluefin tuna and there's, you know, such a scandal around, you know, being the fetishization of that fish. I talk to a lot of fishermen who know for a fact that a lot of bluefin on the market isn't even bluefin anymore. It's big eye. And then there are larger substitutions that occur. Somebody was telling me the other day that she has been fond of ordering grouper and often ends up with Vietnamese pangasius catfish instead, which for those kosher eaters out there is a little bit problematic.
Another asks, can you comment on the impact that omega-3 fish oil is having on the environment and fish population?
It's an excellent question. And I actually think, you know, fish consumption overall per capita has nearly doubled in the last 50 years. And there's projections by the European Union, by the FAO, of the Department of the UN, that trend's only going to continue. And I think it is people obsessed with heart health, with brain health, with their child's neural development, all of these things omega-3s help. But, you know, I always stop, you know, and think, well, what about the health of the earth that we live on? And I think that I would like to see much more people stop thinking about their health first and let them think about the ocean first and their health second.
Another listener wants to know about antibiotics, whether they're used with farm fish, because we've been talking a lot about the inclusion of antibiotics in the feed of farm animals.
Yeah. You know, to my understanding, it was very, very prevalent at the beginning, particularly of salmon aquaculture. The industry has backed off from it, but I wouldn't say it's no, you know, it's still being used. And also, every time you bring a new species into domesticity, and that's happening, you know, all the time now that we've mastered the basic tools of domesticating a fish, when you bring a fish in, you know, all these new diseases crop up, and there's a tremendous incentive for the farmer to try and, you know, kill the disease right away, and antibiotics are often an easy way to do it.
How did the rates of PCBs come to be higher in farmed salmon?
Well, as we were talking earlier, wild salmon are omnivorous. They eat everything. They eat shrimp and crustaceans. They eat much lower on the food chain. Farmed fish only eat other fish, you know, so they're already several what they call trophic levels above what a wild salmon eats. That said, also, at the early days of salmon farming, almost all the feed came from the northern hemisphere. The northern hemisphere is much dirtier than the southern hemisphere. And all those little forage fish that often, you know, spend time in rivers in these polluted parts of the northern hemisphere ended up as feed. Increasingly, the industry is starting to use southern hemisphere food sources. So my guess is that overall PCBs are going down in farmed salmon.
Let's talk about cod.
Yeah.
Cod was the basic fish of much of Europe for a long time.
Sure.
According to one book, the Basque fishermen fished cod coming all the way to the New World over 1,000 years ago, way before Columbus ever came here.
Well, that's what, you know, Mark Karlansky posits, that, you know, the Basque actually discovered America, not the Vikings, and certainly not the Columbus. But
so if they were fishing it and everybody else was fishing the cod, why has cod become so diminished only recently?
It's really about the amping up of what's called fishing effort and the technology. Really, all of our fish problems can be traced back to World War II, because right after World War II, agriculture was devastated. We needed something to eat. And so also parallel to the end of World War II, all these new technologies, right? A lot more oil around, a lot more polymers that you can make into nets and line and all that kind of thing. Sonar is developed, you know, because to find submarines. All these tools are great fish hunting tools. And so suddenly, you know, just the capacity of humans to just catch a lot of fish quickly just booms.
Was cod the fish that was used in the Mrs. Paul's fish sticks?
Yes. You know, cod was very early on used in a lot of the fish sticks. But, you know, it's been replaced. Now, Alaska pollock is really the big deal. And that
is that because we have a lot of it?
Yeah, there's a lot of pollock out there.
And is that going to change? Pollock has also been used to make fake crab, hasn't it?
That's right. That's right. In fact, actually, before Mrs. Paul's and Gorton's of Gloucester and so forth became interested in pollock, it was mostly a lot of Japanese bought Alaska pollock didn't come this way that much. But, it, you know, as I said, when the Georges Bank cod and Grand Banks cod and all those eastern cod species, or stocks rather, collapsed, pollock was slotted in. And now it's starting to show some real problems.
You're right that the very notion of industrial fishing may have to be reexamined.
Yeah. Well, I always say, you know, we cannot subject a wild animal to an industrial process. There is a way to catch fish without destroying things. But, you know, this practice called bottom trawling, which literally drags the bottom clean, destroys the habitat and the fish at the same time. And those kind of super destructive practices really, really need to start ending, and we really need to be much more selective in our fishing.
You mentioned earlier that fish farming began in China, but it was part of a polyculture.
Yeah.
That sounds to me, that makes real sense.
It does.
Is anybody talking about doing something similar today?
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You know, in fact, in Canada, in the Bay of Fundy, there's a really great guy named Thierry Chapin who's doing interesting work with salmon, where, you know, salmon produce a lot of waste, but then there are all these organisms that filter out waste. And so he's got mussels, he's got edible and industrial seaweeds and kelps, and he's got sea cucumbers, and they all filter out a different thing. So you end up, instead of with just one product from your farm, you end up with four, and it makes the water a lot cleaner.
You write about a former cod fisherman, Ted Ames,
yeah,
who believes that fishermen should become more like herders.
Yeah.
Can you explain?
Yeah, well, Ted is interesting because he, you know, he's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and he came ashore, as you know, as he would say, and really started in the, you know, when he couldn't fish anymore, and he started really looking at what the problems were. And he realized that, you know, most fishermen just didn't have the education to manage a complex ecosystem. And his idea is that, you know, if everybody had to pass a test on marine ecology before they could step into the wheelhouse, that they would think twice before taking that extra trawl or that extra long line of codfish in. And if they understand, like a herder understands his flock, you know, what the limits are, then, you know, they'll be much less apt to really screw it up.
Because you want to have more fish next year.
That's right. Well, you know, and again, it's this conversion of an open-ended system where we can always hunt and find more things to a closed system where we have an intimate relationship with our creatures that we hunt.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, whose book, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, is published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've talked recently on the show about the convention that was dealing with hunting whales.
Mm-hmm.
But the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species recently rejected calls to list the bluefin tuna as endangered.
Yep.
And you said that bluefin is pretty much disappearing. So
yeah.
Is this another political issue?
It's very political. What they wanted to do with bluefin was to include it under that convention, which is often pronounced CITES. Basically, that treaty would make it illegal to trade bluefin internationally. And 80% of the bluefin goes to Japan anyway. And so I think that conservationists saw this as a way of basically stanching that hemorrhage that's going in the direction of Japan.
Japan gets blamed for everything.
Well, they certainly should get blamed for bluefin. I mean, and it's interesting what Japan's doing. I just recently found out that the Mitsubishi Corporation, you know, has been hoarding bluefin tuna and keeping it on ice at minus 60 degrees with the idea of selling it at a higher price when there's practically no bluefin left. But they are also investing in a horrible mine in Alaska called Pebble Mine, which is going to be at the headwaters of Bristol Bay, the most important salmon fishery in the world. And I don't know if you saw this, but there was this huge it's a copper mine that they're proposing. China, there was just a copper mine leak that killed 2 million fish in China. Mm. This is the same kind of mine they're planning in Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay, by the way, Bristol Palin, named after Bristol Bay. I'd be interested to hear what Governor Palin has to say about this mine because we're about to destroy some of our most precious wild food.
Well, in some of the upscale fish stores, mm-hmm. we see line caught this and line caught that. Are they really line caught?
I would take the fifth on that one.
Well, as somebody who is a fisherman as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell
I can't imagine you going and getting enough fish line caught to be able to bring it to a fish shop and have them sell it.
Well, you know, there's different degrees of line caught, right? You know, there's the single hook and line. And if you're catching big fish like tuna, then yes, it can be economically worthwhile if you're getting a good price. But sometimes line caught means long line. What a long line is basically a daisy chain of hooks that can be hundreds or even thousands of hooks. There's a little bit of a gray area there. But even said, if we're talking about like there's a great organization called the Cape Cod Hook Fishermen's Association that's doing long lining for haddock and cod, that's much less dangerous or damaging to the bottom structure in those traditional cod grounds. And so I would choose that before I would choose a trawl caught cod.
Have you seen a change in consumer awareness about the kinds of fish choices they're making? For the past few years, certain organizations have been handing out little cards that tell you which fish you can eat and which ones you can't.
Well,
usually the most tasty ones, like sea bass, you can't eat anymore.
Chilean sea bass, yeah, that's a red, although I think there's one stock that's pretty good. I think that there's an awareness. It depends on the market. Certainly places like San Francisco, they're kind of like seafood card Nazis a little bit, you know, waving it in your face to make sure you choose the right food. But what's interesting is that, you know, these cards have not necessarily changed the actual ecological dynamics that are affecting fish because, as I said before, you know, one consumer's abstemiousness is often paired with another's gluttony. And seafood is such an international thing that when we refuse to eat bluefin, it's the Japanese who eat them instead. It's still the same fish. So what I think we need is just an overall raising of consciousness for people to understand that they are eating wild animals.
Well, what role can government play in this? I've seen any number of films about the mixed messages that come from government attempts to save fish.
Yeah.
You suddenly have all of these fishermen saying you're destroying our lives.
Yeah.
So the New England economy is going to go down the tubes as a result of this.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad to see that the Obama administration, you know, announced their ocean initiative. There are real things that we can do without putting fishermen out of work. We need more marine protected areas. You know, we protect 10% of our land area in some kind of protection, like through the National Forest Service, but only 1% of the sea is protected of our American seas. So I'd like to see that number go up. And that's certainly something where government could get involved.
Amy in Manhattan asks, I haven't heard about drift net fishing in a long time, but I don't remember hearing that it had been stopped. Mm-hmm. Is it still going on?
It's certainly been stopped in the high seas. There was a treaty in 1989, and Amy's what she's talking about is these drift nets that sometimes could be, you know, hundreds of miles long, and I think Greenpeace calls them curtains of death, and they would just be let out without even being attached to a boat. They just have a homing signal and a beacon.
And they catch anything.
And they just catch the dolphins and seals and, you know, marlin and swordfish, everything. So, you know, that's an example of, yes, it is possible to change things. And let's also not forget whales. I mean, you mentioned the International Whaling Commission. Since 1986, commercial whaling has been illegal in all but three countries that are abstaining from the moratorium. So there is a possibility for international will to change things, and I remain optimistic about it.
What about mercury? Mm-hmm. At least 20 years ago or so, all we heard about was mercury in swordfish and in tuna, some other fish.
Yeah.
Has that pretty much been cut back on?
No, it hasn't. But, you know, I think in the 70s it was much more, you know, it was much more in people's mind because, you know, there was an initial mercury poisoning that happened in Japan in the Bay of Minamata. And you might have heard of Minamata disease. And there's a very famous photo called Tomo Umemura Takes Her Bath. And it's like a pietà of this incredibly deformed little girl from mercury poisoning. That was a very extreme case, and it stayed in the public mind for a long time. The kind of mercury poisoning we get is much more subtle, and it comes from coal-fired plants. You know, mercury is often in coal seams. It gets what's called methylated when it gets burned, and then it falls into the sea, and then it moves up the food chain. So it's still there. You know, the Obama administration has it within its power to make sure that coal scrubbers, the coal factories put mercury scrubbers on their stacks. I wish they'd do it. I mean, then we wouldn't have a mercury problem anymore.
Meanwhile, you have described bluefin tuna as the last gold rush.
Yeah.
Is that still happening despite the fact that people are much more conscious about the possible end to bluefin?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all tuna is the last gold rush. You know, regulation has gotten more intense on things like cod that we talked about earlier. We now own our seas. Every country owns their sea out to 200 miles, whereas before we only owned our seas as far as you could shoot a cannonball. Like in the 18th century, your sea ended where the cannonball fell. So with that regulation, we've turned to more and more unregulated fish. And tuna cross the very oceans. You know, the Atlantic bluefin swims from the Gulf of Mexico to the coast of Europe. I mean, it's kind of incredible. So if you have all these fish that are crossing oceans, going through many different jurisdictions, you know, they're not really regulatable. And so, you know, tuna across the board, all tuna, bluefin's down by 95-80%, depending on the stock. All tuna species across the board are down by 25%.
So what's your feeling of the future? Are we going to wind up just having to rely more and more on farmed fish?
I think that farming will become more and more the industrial fish that we eat. The fish sticks, the fast food will be the sort of cheap tilapias, catfishes of the world. And I think we're going to have to see wild fish as something that's a bit of a special treat. Instead of eating it, you know, once or twice a week, we might end up have it a couple of times a month. A lot of it depends on whether humans themselves can control our population, because I think, as I said, if we can't control the population, it's only the stars can save us.
I'm going to put a caller on, yeah. David from Yorktown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, David.
Oh, thank you. Hi.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah. No, I was just listening. I'm an ex-commercial fisherman from Alaska.
Yeah.
And I was up there in the Bering Sea, Bristol Bay and stuff, mm-hmm. During the Derby days of the king crab fishery.
Yeah.
And the Fish and Game has really done a very good job, I think, of monitoring the biomass, the catch and stuff, mm-hmm. for sustainability purposes.
Yep.
And I was also a salmon fisherman out of Ketchikan as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and the Fish and Game there, they were super good about making sure there's enough fish got upstream to keep the runs viable for fishermen and stuff. And, you know, we still made, you know, really good money.
Yep.
You know, for a summer's work. But, you know, the Fish and Game, there seems to be, at least in Alaska, a very good, healthy meeting of the minds between what's catchable and what, and the fishermen are also.
Yeah, let me stop you there. I mean, I completely agree with you. Alaska actually has it in its state constitution that fisheries have to be managed sustainably. And salmon, in particular, have been really, really well managed. But, and this is a big but, 30 to 40% of all Alaska salmon begin their lives in a hatchery. And that, to me, indicates that, you know, while, yes, we are making sure enough fish come up the river every year, we're also kind of juking the stats a little bit. And
fewer fish going up the river in Oregon these days?
Well, you know, we've definitely seen huge declines in California, Oregon, and Washington. We lost the California's fishery for 2 years. It just opened again this year. But we're losing those. And it might be because of climate change, but a lot of it is because of dam construction. Alaska, though, has healthy fisheries, but I wish they'd stop the stock supplementation. I just don't think we should be doing that to a beautiful, wild, purely wild run.
Thank you so much for being with us, Paul Greenberg. The book For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, published by the Penguin Press.
Thanks, Leonard. It was great.